So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the continuation of this afternoon's session. Our first speaker is Juan Garcés. He's a project manager of the Greek Manuscripts Digitization Project at the British Library in London. So he's coming from the area about which we learned in the last speech that it's not so much using citations from libraries. Actually, he studied in Germany, but is working since quite some time now in Britain. And he will inform us about their approach towards the old manuscripts of Greek origin in the British Library.
Juan. Thank you very much. When Ronald Milne kindly invited me to give a short presentation here at the 9th International Bielefeld Conference, I thought, well, it's going to be very easy. I put some slides together. I talk on one of my favorite topics. I go and have a leisurely flight from Heathrow to Hannover and then a reasonable train ride from Hannover to Bielefeld. I didn't count with the English weather, however. And so after 10 hours of train and little sleep, I'm here. And I think it's worthwhile nevertheless, and I hope you still think it's worth half an hour of your time to listen to me. So what I'm going to do in the next 20, 25 minutes is merely give you an idea of the scenarios and the issues we are thinking about at the British Library in moving from the traditional brick-and-mortar delivery and services manuscripts into the digital library world, if you like, and playing on the motto of the conference, how we upgrade to the e-library. But before I start with one of the issues I'm going to pick up with later, let me give you a little bit of a background on our manuscript collection. I should perhaps mention that apart from the pre-1600 Western manuscripts that I'm mentioning here, we have a fabulous collection of Asian, Pacific, and African manuscripts, early prints, stamps, and so on and so forth. So this is not by no means the only collection we have, but it is, in any case, one of the world's outstanding manuscript collections. They cover a vast range of historical, literary, biblical, liturgical, devotional, scientific, and medical topics, and I could go on in this vein, and obviously, as such, encompass the whole field of human knowledge from antiquity to the 16th century. It also features most, if not all, major European medieval languages, and we have about 25,000 manuscripts and over 50,000 papyri, charters, and rolls. Now, that's numbers, but those numbers include many iconic treasures. I'm just showing you six of them. Any of my colleagues would have chosen probably six different ones because we have so many of those, one of which is very close to my heart. This is Codex Sinaiticus, the oldest existing Bible that we have in part at the British Library. Of course, the Vatican has a Bible of similar age, but we don't like to mention that very much. So this Bible was the focus of a very successful collaborative project in putting together all the parts that are distributed across four institutions. Some leaves are in Leipzig, at the Leipzig University Library. Some are in St. Petersburg, at the National Library of Russia. In 1975, 12 leaves and 40 fragments were newly discovered, in Sinai in St. Catherine's Monastery, and the lion's share, I should mention, is at the British Library. So these four partners, representing each of these institutions, got together, digitized all the leaves, and put them together in a neat, nice website. Incidentally, this website was developed by the University Library Leipzig, and it was funded by the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft. And I believe somebody called Norbert Lossau was involved in it too. I don't know whether you have heard of that name here in Bielefeld. So I'd like to show this slide because I think it encompasses most of the most important features a virtual research environment focusing on manuscripts should have, in my opinion. Let me point out some of them. We do have, obviously, the images of these pages. They were shot at each venue and they were put together in one server. So we have the digital surrogate that allows the user to zoom in, out, browse, etc. We also have a very detailed content metadata. This was written mostly by myself, and edited from other contributors. We do have a transcription of the text. Yes, for 2 years, two scholars sat down day after day looking at these pages and transcribed the text of Codex Sinaiticus. And this is very important because, obviously, the text of Codex Sinaiticus is important, but also because it is very difficult to perform an optical character recognition on images, on manuscripts. But on the other hand, it's very important to make these texts available and searchable and so on. We also feature a translation, and incidentally, most of the emails that I receive about this website concern the translation. People want more translation. Not the whole site is translated yet, but you can see that manuscripts are not only relevant to a tiny group of manuscript specialists, but indeed for a very wide audience. Last, and certainly not least, we had a group of conservators going through each page and meticulously noting all physical features that you find. A little damage here, a little repair there. And that is very interesting and important too, because we hope this functions as a standard for future descriptions of manuscripts of this kind. There's, however, an issue with this highly successful project, and that is it doesn't scale very well. Imagine a project like this done, undertaken on each of our 25,000 manuscript volumes and over 50,000 papyri, ostraca, and so on. It would be impossible. We would never finish. So how can we take what is good about this project and take it forward into a realm that scales very well and delivers the manuscripts of the British Library as a digital library? Well, I can let you know that we are planning and fundraising for such an approach. In fact, we have already secured some initial funding for a pilot project, and we are planning to mass digitize most, if not all, pre-1600 manuscripts. There's a series of pilot projects, one of which I already mentioned. It's the Greek Manuscript Digitization Project, which I am lucky to manage. And what we will do is we will digitize a relatively small number, 250 manuscripts. We will create some item-level catalog descriptions, in other words, content metadata, and we will design a suitable web environment. And this is interesting because we will hold a series of advisory panel workshops where we invite experts in manuscripts, experts in digitization, and indeed experts in digital humanities in creating this new web environment. However, let me focus on a very small group of manuscripts, the Greek papyri at the British Library. They're very interesting. We have over 3,000 of those. 250 of them are literary, that is, they contain biblical text, Homer, and so on and so forth, some of which very, very important. The rest is obviously not literary, but there's a small group of them, 260, who belong to one of the most important archives of the ancient world, the Sinon Archive. Now, why is an archive important? Well, there we have a group of manuscripts that contain letters, accounts, descriptions of all sorts, and all organized along one community, one archive, and that allows us to put all these informations together and recreate the world in the third pre-Christian era, century rather, sorry. There are, of course, some challenges and opportunities, and I think this is why looking at papyri is particularly interesting. First of all, there are different genres demanding different approaches. If a researcher looks at a literary papyrus and looks at a documentary, the questions asked will be quite different. In terms of literary papyri, obviously, there will be the desire to compare it with other manuscripts that feature the same text and see in what way it differs and so on. In terms of documentary papyri, the questions will be entirely different. Also, the nature of papyri means they break very easily. And on top of that, people who sold them discovered very early on that they make more money if they let them break and sell them to different people, or institutions in this case. So this is a very interesting case too, because it obliges, it forces repositories and scholars to look at papyri that are distributed across different institutions and have different kinds of content metadata and so on and so forth. Luckily, the papyrus experts community is very well organized, very active, and are very good at doing computing, and therefore they are a very good case in thinking about developing access to manuscripts in a digital world. Let me go to the first series of issues that I would like to talk here, and that is resource integration. I will explain why this is important. If you go to the catalog, which is digitally available right now on the British Library website, and search for random papyrus, in this case 2358, you will find an entry or a description, rather, a catalog description like this one. It's very good, it's decent, but of course it was written in the 1930s, so the latest bibliography hasn't been added, and some new discoveries have been made since then. Now, if you step back and look around at the World Wide Web, you will find something like this. These are four screenshots from different projects and at different universities. For example, here you have the Heidelberger Gesamtverzeichnis, which features content descriptions of all documentary papyri that are known, and hence also the papyri at the British Library. And incidentally, Heidelberger Gesamtverzeichnis is only the short name. I amuse my English colleagues by saying the long name is Heidelberger Gesamtverzeichnis der griechischen Papyrusurkunden Ägyptens, and that this is only the short version. There's a longer version somewhere else. Down here you see a database at the University of Liège in Belgium, which contains, again, up-to-date, high-quality metadata on literary papyri. Here you find a project in Leuven, beneath another one in Leuven, with information on our papyri. So there's information out there which is freely available on the papyri that we host, that we curate, and this should be certainly integrated. If you look further on the internet, you'll find something like this. This is from the Persois Digital Library at the University of Tufts, with mirror sites in Berlin, Oxford, and Chicago, and you will find whole transcriptions, whole texts of the texts featured in our papyri, searchable, downloadable, freely available in a standard format. Looking even further, I choose two projects here. You will find something like Pleiades. Pleiades is a project which collects information about ancient place names and what they refer to and how they change. So you might find a situation where something was a village at one time in Egypt, it evolved into a city, then it was destroyed in a war, it became an archaeological site. And Pleiades is one of these projects that collects all these data and creates unique identifiers and geo-reference data and allows you to extract them as an atom feed, so ready to be reused already. To the right, you see a similar project, but this time on personal names. So every person that is mentioned in an ancient document is featured on this lexicon of Greek personal names, including all the other mentions. So for us, it would be very interesting because we know in the Sinon archive, for example, a certain person is mentioned, but the same person is also perhaps mentioned somewhere else, and that is very important for a papyrologist to know. So what do you do with all this? Now, this is a stereotypical mashup that friends of mine have undertaken. So you have a number of small windows that are asynchronically generated from different servers that are all over the world. So you have an image, in this case from Toronto. You have some content metadata from a project at Duke University. You have the transcription of the same kind, as mentioned before, from the Duke database, and you have a translation. And all put together from freely available data out there and assembled to a rich and very valuable resource for researchers. Now, doing something like this is quite desirable, but also brings with it a number of challenges with which we have to deal. Most of these will be known to you very well. To start with, we have different data models based on the different kinds of data that we want to put together. Even the databases that contain similar kinds of data, for example, the content metadata, use different data models, and we have to cater for that. And even when the data models are similar enough or comparable or map on a one-to-one basis, they might be in different formats, or they might even not be in any established standard. And last but not least, there is the lack of established protocols, although some very promising protocols in exchanging data are emerging on the horizon. But the really famous cases of web technology and research do not come so much from resource integration, but rather from user-generated content. Wikipedia is the first case that jumps to mind, and indeed it's very successful, albeit not entirely without problems. What kinds of user-generated contents are we looking for the manuscripts at the British Library? Well, first of all, we would like people to be able to tag manuscripts. We could do this in a variety of ways. We could leave whatever keyword jumps to their mind. This is what you refer to as a folksonomy. I created another word. I don't know whether it exists already, and I just called it expertonomy. And that is basically whatever, quite often not written down, not established, whatever set of technical terms are used in the scholarly community in reference to the objects that we host. And in fact, these are just the two extremes, and we could look at developing folksonomies into the other end and so forth. And there's, of course, the idea of descriptions. And one person's camel hoop, it's another person's McDonald's sign, as you see on this picture. And it's equally the case with, for example, illuminations in manuscripts or in paleographical descriptions of hands, for example. And this is very important for us too, and we want to certainly integrate that. Transcriptions are crucial. I already mentioned why this is the case. Manuscripts are not easily digitized in terms of text because they have been written by hand, and it's very difficult to perform an optical character recognition. And last but not least, we want to generate discussion and communities, which I will show here. And clearly, these are the standard ways in which Web 2 technology has succeeded in bringing people together in terms of social networking. So you want to come to the British Library website. You're interested in a number of manuscripts. You want to know who else is interested in those manuscripts because they might be tackling similar issues. They might be wanting to answer similar questions. Let's say the catalog descriptions on these manuscripts changes, perhaps even dramatically. A manuscript is redated. You want to know about this. You want to be able to subscribe and be notified if this is the case. And last but not least, you want to be able to exchange your views and your questions in a forum with experts. Now, in order to do this, we need tools. And some of the tools for collaborative editing are already well known and established. And it would be relatively straightforward to carry them over and apply them to the world of the manuscripts. What you see here is really three examples of a tool that is being developed right now. And it shows how existing tools perhaps need some tweaking in order to be useful for the scholarly community. Now, it's a bit small, but take my word for it. This is how a scholar, a Greek papyrologist, say, would transcribe a text on his or her notepad or Word document. And this is how it looks on this field. This is XML, Text Encoding Initiative Schema. This is how the computer would like it. And This is quite important because we want to be able to search and compare across vast amounts of transcription, 25,000 plus, as I mentioned. And this is just one of the possible outputs you can have if you have edited your text not in this format, but in this XML format. So what is happening here is a group of scholars is trying to write scripts that unambiguously transform this into this code and therefore is able to export in this code and make it exchangeable and interoperable with other interested projects. Now, there are, of course, challenges and issues here, too. For example, moderation model. I'm sure that you have been following the news last week or this week. I think it was last week when the founder of Wikipedia, horror of horrors, suggested that a more stricter moderation model would be needed to develop Wikipedia. And it has, in fact, moderation models are very important. And I think it's also important to allow for different approaches for different kinds of media. For example, when it's about a transcription, we will want to be very strict. A text that is written on the manuscript can't be transcribed in any kind of way. However, with content description, we might be able to allow some differences of opinion. And this is what we will be experimenting with in the pilot project. The question is, who can participate in such a user interface? Is it open to everyone? Is it closed? Is it controlled? As in, do we need passwords and so on and so forth? And I think the answer to this question is it might be each of these cases for different projects and different applications. I think in principle it will be open to everyone, of course. We might allow a group of scholars for a time a closed access to a number of manuscripts because that is what the group might be focusing on that time. What kind of moderation, peer moderation or otherwise, are we going to perform on the contents? Is it going to happen before, after, during? Are we just going to publish what people add in terms of user-generated contents? Well, again, I think the answer is it depends, and we will have to try out different models and see what works best. Now, the big anxiety amongst curators is, what can we vouch for? How can we vouch for some high-quality contents on the British Library website, in this case? And how can we guarantee that the quality for which we are known, and of course all the institutions are known, is being upheld in this approach? In other words, how is user-generated content presented, perhaps vis-a-vis existing quality-assured contents? And last but not least, we want mostly scholars to use this interface. And the question is, how can scholars profit from this kind of interaction? What kind of crediting model or licensing model are we opting for? I'm thinking of something similar to Wikipedia, in fact, where you can actually trace back who has been editing what at what time. And perhaps in terms of allocating evaluations on this kind of work, it might be important to rethink how we value publications from scholars in this area. Now, this is my final slide, and I'll check how much time I have. I won't take more than 3 minutes, okay? And basically what I want to do now is I want to show you how upgrading manuscripts to the e-library will change services and roles at the British Library. So what I have here are very basically three columns, one that shows the roles of British Library staff, the services they provide in the middle, and towards the right, the roles and services used by the users or the readers, as you might. So this is where we are now. What we have is we have a bottom layer of content description. Without a good catalog, no manuscript library is accessible. This is very important to our knowledge. And of course, we do have the manuscripts themselves, which we make available. And lately, we have been offering some imaging services for those who want to buy the images. So we have roles on the left, such as conserving the manuscript and preserving it and curating the contents and indeed the manuscripts. And to the right, you have researching and reading roles. And going into the digital realm, you have imaging, delivering these imaging, and of course preserving the images themselves, and very similar roles to the end. But what you observe is, following the arrows, that there is a distinct movement from left to right. There is a provider on the one end and a consumer on the other. And I think this is what might change very soon once we build the virtual research environment I've been introducing, at least conceptually here. So we will have users editing content descriptions, and therefore that will feed back into the catalog. We will have transcriptions, hopefully, a research space where users can look at the images and aggregate resources, as I mentioned before, and obviously community spaces as well as personal spaces where researchers can take notes and so on. Now, it's more of a back and forth, and the roles on the left are slightly differing. And I like to think about these roles not in terms of replacing traditional roles, but rather extending the skill set and the services and roles that curators, in this case, and other library staff have to adopt in order to deal with this new e-library approach. And, of course, the same happens to the right. So that there's more feedback from both sides. There's more interaction. And I would argue, due to this flow back and forth, there's also more co-ownership from the users in the newly created collaborative set of data that constitutes the virtual research environment. Of course, the same goes for larger inter-institutional exchange, where we hope to be collaborating with a host of projects, some of which I know are represented here, and we hope that they are equally happy to give back. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Juan. Good example how the combination of well-organized community, digital technology, and a good strategy can add use value to a bundle of resources.